This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Michael Shaw. This is episode 292 with Madeline Hollander. She is an artist, a choreographer, and a former professional ballet dancer based essentially bi-coastally in Los Angeles and New York. And she has a show up as we speak called Flatwing at the Whitney Museum. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can see indeed images from Flatwing, as well as some of Madeline's other work, including some choreographed dances and an installation or two. We only have 5 images up on the website. Maybe I'll put a couple more. You'll definitely be able to see more eventually via Instagram. The show Flatwing actually officially opened on the day that Madeline and I recorded. Coincidentally, I suppose, enough. But it runs into August, I believe. So if you are in New York or you will be in New York, you will definitely have a chance to see it. More on the show in a second. Just a couple of quick updates. So people who have been listening regularly may remember the couple of episodes I did with artist Steve Lambert, who is one of the co-directors of the Center for Artistic Activism. So all that to say that I just finished doing the workshop slash training that they recently put on over the course of a month with myself and about 25 or 6 other people from various disciplines and careers and whatnot. A lot of people in organizing and nonprofits and so on, but a few artists mixed in and designers and whatnot. So anyway, all that to say as well that if you are thinking about or are even in the process of working on some kind of action that you want to bring attention to, that you want to bounce a bit, you know, publicity-wise and be effective and so on, I might be able to help you. Just let me know. Maybe I'll expand on my experience, certainly as it evolves in terms of how I apply it going forward. But I want to just let you know about that. Couple of other things before we jump in. If you are a fan of this podcast, a great way to show your support is to pledge to us through our Patreon, where you can make micro donations to the show monthly. And a huge thanks to our ongoing Patreon donors. Or you can make one-time donations various ways, all linked through theconversationpod.com/support. You can also show your support non-financially by leaving a strong review either on Apple Podcasts, where more people listen than elsewhere, apparently, or wherever you listen. You can also follow us at Artist Podcast on Instagram, and you can follow me there as well, Michael Shaw Art. Big thanks to Allison Widows for her invaluable help, as well as Van Cashinero. And I want to thank Carolyn McKinley at the Whitney for getting the ball rolling and having Madeline as a guest on the show. So before we jump in, finally, regarding Flatwing, which is largely about what's happening with crickets, particularly flat-winged crickets. More on that in the conversation. Madeline went to go see if she could find them on the island of Kauai. There are other locales, I guess, in the Pacific, South Pacific region. You will never, after you hear this conversation, think about crickets quite the same way again. I have crickets, as I mentioned in the podcast, at my studio, and I have to say, this doesn't come up in our conversation, it is very hard to count how many chirps a cricket makes in 14 seconds. Try it. Let me know if you can do it, and let me know your strategy, because they go fast when it's warm. It's fast. All right. I think that's all you need to know, except for the fact that the audio on my end of this recording, in this case, sounds a little bit too much like a phone call than me in the room like I am now. So that is the result of transitioning to the new recording setup. So a channel was off, let's just say. But you can hear me just fine. It's just a little wonky. So thank you for bearing with it. Thank you very much for being here, for listening. Let us know what you think. Feel free to reach out via theconversationpod.com. Hope you're doing well. I am nearing my second vaccination next week. I hope you guys are along that route as well, or if not already done, and mazel if you already are. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you again in a couple of weeks. Until then, stay healthy, be well.
So, did you get a dance when you were a kid? What's the sort of overarching story there?
I guess the origin story is that I was dancing around the house and my parents signed me up for local ballet classes, not knowing that the studio that they had selected was a pre-professional training academy and very serious and not the kind of, it's something that they were not anticipating. And I fell in love with it and just kind of dove in head first and, or feet first or whatever that is.
Right.
And ended up, you know, doing that and pursuing school and, you know, going to rehearsal before, during, and after school every single day, and then continuing to dance through college, where I kind of had this double life where I was having all of my classes in the evening and would train downtown in the morning. And I kind of did the reverse order that's typical to a ballet dancer, where I actually joined a company after graduating from university instead of not going to university to join a company, because you usually start at a really young age. And then joined Los Angeles Ballet and did a tour of Serenade, and then joined Angel Correa's Ballet, which was in Madrid, and then moved to Barcelona and did an international tour of Swan Lake.
What was your role in Swan Lake?
I was a swan. I was in every single act. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. It's extremely exhausting, and your every single muscle cramps up and starts shaking in different points of each act. And by the end of the tour, I actually broke my foot on stage and continued performing and finished the tour not knowing that it was broken and just assumed that it was another strain, and then went back to New York and got an MRI and went from, you know, directly from class and training into a boot for 6 months. And that kind of kickstarted my focus to kind of re-guide my, I guess, to kind of fuse together my studies in anthropology and my degree from Columbia and my passion for ballet into choreography. And I would say that's when my my choreography really began.
Right. It sounds like the way you just described it, you were really ready for a post-ballet, you know, life, right? It wasn't the way you sort of described it. It wasn't as if, oh, you know, I broke my foot or my toe and then I had to reassess everything and kind of figure out how I was going to start over. It was almost, it sounds as if it was, you know, the transition was fairly smooth, or is that misleading?
I wouldn't say it was smooth. I would say it was pretty traumatic, but it was also something that I think I intuited on one level, not through ever thinking I would break my foot or injure myself, but I definitely had the feeling when I was on tour that I didn't really fit in, and that, or I guess I realized that not every ballet dancer is an artist, and that a lot of ballet dancers and a lot of dancers are athletes. And they don't really have the drive to be continuously creating their own work. And I kind of felt muted in a way the entire time I was on tour. Not in a way that was, you know, I felt resentment towards, but I could tell that I needed an outlet that was more than performing on the stage and performing other people's work. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that, you know, how that was going to manifest, but it was definitely a feeling that was really present throughout that experience.
This is a question that, you know, we could obviously get into the weeds about and maybe shouldn't, but I still am curious, where is the line between a ballet dancer who is an athlete and an artist? You know what I mean? Like, is it, if you're performing somebody else's work just sort of repetitively, you know, does that not really leave room for art? Do you can one be an athlete but be so good that they transcend in such a way to be an artist? Or, you know, is that semantics, or what do you think?
so completely. I think that the best athletes are artists, and you know, those are the people that I look up to and are inspired by, and the reason why I continue to dance. And it's, you know, you hit this transcendent level where all of a sudden these very technical movements become magical and become otherworldly. And that feeling is something that's, you know, you're reaching towards the impossible constantly. And that, mm-hmm. that was what, you know, was drew me so intensely and still does to ballet in particular. And I think the same thing applies to really any discipline. It's once you kind of become a master of a technique and you work that hard at it, you can either become a technician and really, you know, become reliable at that form, which a lot of companies need for the corps de ballet, or you can use that as a stepping stone to kind of create something that's your own and take these solos that already exist in these roles and completely transform them into something that is, you know, relevant to today's culture, today's politics, to the feelings that are happening in the world, and kind of tap into something that's bigger than the sum of its parts. And that's artistry. I think that there's the other part that I should probably discern is more of a creative drive. So it was, you know, filling up notebooks of ideas of different choreographies and films and productions and things that I wanted to do and ideas that were forming in my brain that just kind of felt like they were getting stuck in my notebook because mm-hmm. I was dancing 16 hours a day and then
right.
soaking and icing and then going to bed and doing it again.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the fact that you went to university when typically ballet dancers, you know, skip university so that they, you know, because they start early, right? So that you were forming the processing that leads to thinking about things creatively. Is that, I don't know, I don't want to flatten the, you know, the distinction,
yeah.
that, you know, but does that kind of feel right?
No, completely. Yeah. Yeah. I think that it was really telling when I had gotten an offer from San Francisco Ballet and I had gotten into Barnard and Berkeley and all these colleges, and I was completely I was paralyzed. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to make the decision. And I really didn't want to choose one or the other, which is why I ultimately chose being in New York City, because I knew I could continue my training and mm-hmm. train with some of the best instructors in the world, mm-hmm. As well as getting this education and really dive into these other areas that were, for me, just as, you know, completely, I guess, integrated into my idea of movement and ballet and dance. I just wasn't sure how to articulate it yet.
Yeah. 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 And the other thing that I'm thinking about too, is you're describing all the context of being a ballet dancer and then figuring out what to do next and studying anthropology, right? So that your choreography was evolving as you were dancing in your mind, you know, it seemed like it was starting, you know, a parallel in some ways.
Completely. And I think I was observing everyday movements and, you know, gestures and postures since the day that I started dance and, you know, studying cultural anthropology. And in specific, I was focusing on the evolution of our corporeal vocabularies and how our gestures and postures and everyday movements have evolved so quickly due to the influx of new technology and interface design and change in the change of pace and culture. And so I felt like that critical eye was, you know, formed the second I started a movement practice, and I kind of got to use anthropology as a lens to create these studies and do field work mm-hmm. to kind of go deeper into that.
Mm-hmm. Is there an example of doing field work that is particularly anecdotal, you know, as far as, you know, having a really strong picture or, you know, or interaction or both that comes to mind?
I guess one of the things that I did was set up a project called Gesture Archive, where I would invite anyone to my studio and capture these full body movement portraits of them. And we would conduct this very casual conversation. Sometimes it would last 20 minutes, sometimes 6 hours. It was really up to, you know, whoever was there and what they felt. at the time and how much they wanted to share. And I was not recording sound. And so the point of these sessions was for me to just capture these very authentic, genuine movements that they would produce while having this conversation with me. And then I would go through the footage at the end and isolate their signature moves, gestures that were specific to a certain technology, like how they would gesture to say, call me or text me, or how they would open a door or enter or exit a room. And then categorize these and make these tiny little, almost like gifs. They weren't gifs, but they were just like 2-second clips, and made hundreds of these that then I put into this space or this archive called Gesture Archive. And it at once became, you know, this cultural study, and it was something that I could, you know, put dates on and kind of study how these movements and gestures evolved. But then it also played as this incredible source of inspiration for whenever I was creating a choreography and needed some ideas. And I would open up all of these videos and play them all at once and begin suturing them together to create movement sequences. So I feel like I was always kind of doubling my my work, so that one side of it would kind of fall into the research side and the other side of it would fall into the choreographic inspiration side. And
did you happen to have one of the people come to your studio be a hearing impaired person of any kind? And I only ask because it seems like their, you know, gesture vocabulary would be have more language to it.
Yeah, I didn't actually, but I did have people come in who were fluent in sign language, and so I asked them to, you know, demonstrate some of the some words. And I mean, one of the things that I found in general was, as people would come to my studio and know that I'm a choreographer, the first 30 minutes to an hour, they would be actually performing and kind of anticipating that I would want huge movements or more dancer-like movements, when really I was looking for that little twitch of a pinky or the raise of an eyebrow when they're trying to remember something, or the tilt of the head when they've forgotten the name of someone, and very kind of micro gestures. So one of the reasons why a lot of the sessions would, you know, take hours would be to kind of get past this intro, which was, I found, to be more performative and more self-conscious, and into a realm where it felt much more like an authentic conversation. And, you know, of course there's a camera there and that's always going to affect it, but something where I could, you know, pull this movement and be like, oh, this is a signature move that I would associate with this person. Or like, I guess the way I would describe signature moves are, if you're playing charades and, you know, everyone's name was in the hat and you pulled out someone's name and you had to do one movement that would describe them, which I'm sure you could think of for all of your close friends or family members, that would be their signature move. So I was hunting for that in these sessions.
Right. Do you ever have the opportunity to imitate people for fun in that regard?
I mean, imitate them in the sense of incorporate or steal all of these movements to become integrated into new movement sequences. So you can see in my choreography that, you know, they're composed of hundreds of people's signature moves. And, you know, I'm just culling what I see and not really creating movements from scratch ever. It's really more of a collage process of found choreographies.
And so one other sort of presumption that I have from your transition, you know, out of dance, you know, because of your injury and whatnot, is your choreography was already underway, right? And so you were, and you were exploring that sort of along as part of your anthropology. And so all that to say, there's a lot of choreography that has been going on in contemporary art, you know, in the last several years. So so here's my presumption that I'm finally getting to, which is, it seems like it would be hard to pin down. Would it be hard to pin down? I should put it as a question. Would it be hard to pin down a moment where you sort of became a quote unquote art, you know, a visual artist? Or, you know, was it like this you were transitioning, and then, you know, at some point that's what happened?
That's a good question. I think I've always considered myself a visual artist, whether or not I was dancing or making videos or drawing, just in the sense that it feels visual to me.
Right.
But this, I guess most of my community of friends were artists. I wasn't really hanging out with my dancer friends, and I'm not entirely sure why, but I was definitely, you know, my community were filmmakers and artists and people who were, and in kind of constant dialogue with that group, and going to see openings and going to see French shows and really engaged in what was happening in New York at that time. And I really didn't feel like there was enough performance or dance in the art world. And where dance did exist, like at Lincoln Center or these theaters, it was extremely expensive. It was not, there was really, I mean, there's still very little crossover, but it's definitely improved significantly in terms of the amount of artists who go see dance and know about dancers, and the amount of dancers that go see art and know about artists. And I really felt strongly about creating dance and movement and conceptual work that would be free, in the sense that you could go into a gallery for free, and, you know, you don't have to pay an entrance to go see a friend's work. And I don't think any of my friends saw any, you know, I performed Swan Lake for 2 years. None of my friends saw me dance. I wasn't expecting them to either. But the second I created a piece for a gallery, or then all of a sudden all my friends could be there, and, you know, dancers could be there, artists could be there, filmmakers. And it was a nice way to kind of join those worlds together for me.
So I'm thinking, as inaccessible in a lot of ways that contemporary art is, the sort of implication here is that dance is even more inaccessible, right? Maybe cost prohibitive, if nothing else.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, there's a very specific start time and end time for dances, or, you know, you have to be there at 7:45. It starts at 8:00. If you're not there in time, you can't even go in. And, you know, it ends at a specific time. And I never really saw my work as having a start or a finish. I wanted it to be perceived as you would a work of art, or something hanging on a wall or an installation. And really loved the idea that people could go experience movement and dance by walking into a gallery whenever they like and leaving whenever they like, and not really knowing exactly where they're going to find the piece. And, you know, having the feeling where they could feel comfortable turning their back towards a dancer in this, and have a conversation with someone.
Right.
While continuing to kind of absorb the work. And yeah, that was very exciting to me.
And if you sort of, the way that I'm thinking about it anyway, is if you can sort of continue to play that, those models out as far as accessibility, my sense is from what our prior conversation, you've definitely done this to some extent, is putting the work out in the world in public.
No, I think that my favorite place to create performances for is in the public and outdoors. And, you know, I've done pieces on Rockaway Beach, in the streets in Buenos Aires, outside of the Whitney, on the Hudson. For me, the idea that a random pedestrian, as well as an audience who knows about what's going on, as well as an onlooker, you know, someone who's biking by, can all experience a work that is either a complete surprise or something that was, you know, planned for, pulls everything together for me. It's that feeling of a fused audience, where you have people who are hyper aware of what's going on, perhaps know me, know my work, and have, you know, an idea or read about the concept. And then you have people who are experiencing this thing that perhaps they don't even know if it's a dance, if it's a performance, if it's work, if it's labor, if it's construction. And I really, I try to hit those in-between zones so that there is a level of confusion, but also a sense of spectacle, so people want to pay attention and kind of try and discern what is happening.
Yeah, I was trying to think, as you were talking about that, if I've seen any live dance, you know, on the street, and I can't I'm sure I would remember it if I have, so I don't think I have. Have you gotten any memorable, have you gotten any comments from people you didn't know who got to see any of these performances and that you remember?
Oh, yeah. I mean, from, you know, postal workers to people pushing strollers to traffic cops. I mean, it's always it starts up really wonderful conversations, and sometimes there's conflicting ones where we're in a place where we're not allowed to be, and you know, I have to leave the performance and go talk to the law enforcement and explain what's happening and show that I have gotten permission. Or, I mean, there's always a lot of adrenaline and friction because not everyone is always informed that this is going to happen. And, you know, I find that people within the audience are engaging with people who have never seen this type of work, and they're starting conversations with each other. And sometimes pedestrians will just join in, and they will just kind of jump into the movement or kind of participate or start miming the choreography and, you know, want to be seen. And I love that as well.
That's great. Let's talk about Flatwing, starting from the beginning. To use the old origin story prompt, what was your first experience with crickets that you can remember that in any way connected with this project?
Yeah, I guess growing up in Los Angeles in a canyon, I would hear crickets every single night, and somewhere learned, I'm not sure exactly where, that if you, you know, that there's a correlation between the rate of their chirping and the temperature outside, and learned that if you count the number of chirps in 14 seconds and then add 40, you'll get the degree in Fahrenheit. So as a kid, I would kind of, I remember being very aware of what the temperature was every single night, whether it was 68 degrees or 78 degrees. And kind of forgot about that after living in New York for 16 years. And when I was researching and developing this piece called New Max, which was developing a choreography that uses temperature as its axis, and the choreography was designed to heat up the room, so the dancers and their body heat would be raising the temperature in the room, and I set up a network between air conditioner units, these temperature sensors, the lighting, and the dancers to continuously heat up the room, and then when they hit a max temperature, the lights would go off, the AC units would turn on, and they would have to wait for it to go back down 5 degrees. And then the next round, they would continue their choreography, and they would have to get it 1 degree higher than they did before. So they'd have to go up 6 degrees. And so this was this kind of crescendoing, rigorous, heat-inducing choreography. And while developing that work and rehearsing with the dancers, I remembered my association with crickets and temperature, and thought that it would be a good idea to use crickets as the soundscape for this piece, and kind of fantasized at the idea of bringing in thousands of crickets to be these live accompaniment that would actually chirp in tempo with whatever temperature the dancers had brought the room to, and you know, started Googling how to purchase crickets in bulk, and very quickly realized, A, that's like kind of an, you know, the ethics around that were so off. B, the way that you purchase crickets in bulk is usually like half frozen blocks of you know, half dead crickets that are used as feed for reptiles. And so that idea got squashed pretty quickly, but I then came across all of these headlines that kind of knocked the wind out of me, that were detailing how the crickets in Kauai have, and in the other islands in Hawaii, have gone silent. And that kind of kicked off this research.
Right, right. Well, that's just fascinating, though, that there's this match, you know, this math that you can do that seems almost random. And then I also want to just say, before we get more into the video, how, because this kind of goes back to you know, what you found out in researching crickets and even just from the very beginning of your, you know, growing up with them, how that stat about them going silent is, when you read it on the screen, it feels kind of tragic. Is that how it felt to you?
Yeah, I guess it didn't feel, it felt more like an alarm or like, it was like this sonic horizon line that had kind of been a grounding or kind of a served as a compass for me all of a sudden was gone. And it resonated in a way that was really ominous because I was researching, I've also, you know, this work I was researching also has a lot to do with climate change and the rise of global temperatures, and the choreography was is kind of a representation of this, what I call a zip tie effect, where like these average temperatures are each year kind of going one notch higher than the year before. And, you know, that means that the average high and low just continuously go up and up and up instead of staying where they've been for a while. And so the fact that these kind of temperature thermometers were going mute or that were silenced felt at this time where the globe is experiencing such drastic, you know, global warming effects, felt almost as if like the siren that has been on for so long all of a sudden went off. And that served as an alarm, kind of ironically, for me.
Talk about, just briefly, about what happened that led to the silencing of the crickets in Kauai, and, you know, you mentioned the other islands as well. Something to do with this fly that basically became their predator.
Yeah, so over the last, I guess, 10 to 15 years, this parasitic fly, which is acoustically oriented, has been attacking and kind of dive bombing the chirping crickets and laying their eggs on the backs of chirping crickets, which are the males, and the eggs would burrow in and kill the cricket and, you know, essentially wiping them out. And scientists went to go take count and look at, you know, what was happening to the populations, and they discovered that the island was actually completely populated by crickets. However, the ones that were populated were populating the islands were not the normal chirping crickets. They were silent, and discovered that over the course of a 10-year period, the crickets that had a very rare mutation, where they're considered the cross-dressing crickets, where the male crickets that did not have ridges on their wings, so that when they would attempt to rub their wings together, it would produce no sound, which used to be the losers because they weren't able to create a mating call, all of a sudden became the alpha male because they had an invisibility cloak. The parasitic fly would, you know, go out listening for the chirp, and they would be, you know, creating the movements to chirp and producing no sound, and they would pass right over them. So those were the ones that were left over that were available to mate with the females. And kind of in a, this is an example of accelerated evolution. And one of the reasons there's so many articles about this phenomenon is because this, you know, repopulation of the silent crickets happened in 10 years, in a decade, when usually something of that scale or timeline usually takes over, you know, 10,000 years.
Wow.
And so right now, the crickets that are, the silent crickets are actually relying wholly on the remaining chirping crickets, which are at like 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And they're attracting a female by hovering around the, you know, last chirping cricket in their neighborhood. They kind of hover around it. They do this thing called a satellite technique or satellite behavior. And they essentially ventriloquize this chirping cricket. So they're doing the movement. They're all in sync with each other. And then a female comes because the female is attracted to the chirp. And this silent cricket will intercept and get the female before the more passive chirping cricket even knows what happens.
Wow. So, spoiler alert for people in New York who are going to go see the show. I just want to give my own sort of attempt at a really brief synopsis, and you can sort of, you know, correct and or take it from there. But so it's a 16-minute video projected in the space. I haven't seen it, but you know, that you mentioned the projection earlier, and it's mainly infrared. It's all infrared, right? Photography or
yeah.
Video of you sort of trying to find these silent crickets in the brush in Kauai, right? And meanwhile, you're having phone conversation with this woman who's been leading the study, or one of the leaders, I guess, of the studies of this situation, who's a University of Minnesota based science biologist, right? And then just one other thing I'll say about it, and you can take over, is that in the conversations with her, you're sort of like angling for your own kind of narrative about what's happening, and she's kind of like sort of quashing your narrative on an ongoing basis. Like, no, like one of the main things I remember is she said, you know, no, it doesn't really make sense for us to film them. We just chart them, right? Whereas you're right. Like, as a choreographer, well, why wouldn't you want to film them? I mean, it's fascinating, right? And so finally, later on in the video, you see, you know, some close-ups of the crickets, and one in a jar, which I have to say was a little alarming, you know, in terms of the fact that they're so vulnerable. But anyway, that's my long premise for you.
Yeah, well, those are not crickets.
Oh, okay, right, that's right. I apologize.
Didn't find any crickets. Yeah.
Right, thank you for clarifying. Yeah, you say in the video, I apologize. You say in the video, in the text at the end, that you never found a cricket, but you did find all these other insects. So what was the one that I mistakenly was calling a cricket?
That was a katydid. I kept on getting excited every time I found one because they do look kind of similar. And then I would send images to Marlene, the scientist, and she would be like, nope, that's a katydid. Or
nope, that's
a cicada. Or kind of just putting me back in my phase one.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's an infrared video. It is, I wouldn't say it's of me, but it's actually, you know, I use the camera as night goggles. So I was, you see this kind of first person, very subjective expedition through this jungle and through looking in grass and the woods and mulch and moss. And it was not something when I was shooting it that I ever thought I was going to share with the public. It was primarily for research, and I really was trying to find the movements and capture the movements of this species, which they didn't have footage of. And which I had been told by Marlene, the evolutionary biologist, was on the brink of extinction. So just to back up a bit, I had, months before going to Kauai, I had called her when I had, you know, was reading all these articles and gotten in contact with her. And I just wanted to get the footage of this satellite behavior. I was really curious about their new locomotive behaviors, which had been written about in these scientific articles. But no diagrams, no detailed explanation of what that was. For me as a choreographer, I was completely fascinated and thought that this would be such good material to incorporate into this new Max piece that I was at the time developing. So reached out, asked, can I please have all the footage from your lab and from the field work? I'd love to use this for this project. And it kind of explained my work and got this response back that was just like, we don't have footage. Why would we need footage? And was so shocked. And so I set up this call and I asked Marlene, you know, I just had this conversation with her, and I also had no idea I was going to use that conversation for anything. I had only recorded it because she was speaking so fast and she was using terminology that I was not familiar with. You know, she's a evolutionary biologist and entomologist. And so I asked to record it, and it was a really crappy kind of iPhone record over Skype thing that, you know, I didn't listen to until I was halfway through editing the film. And the expedition is me just, I mean, to summarize that phone call, I had all these ideas that I had this romantic idea that given everything I've read about this new species and their, you know, the fact that they can't produce the chirp, the sound, but that they have all these new behaviors and these new techniques, I thought that I would be able to witness, or I thought this meant I would be able to witness the evolution of a new mating dance and see like a evolutionary choreography within my lifetime, which is extremely exciting. And was convinced that this was happening, you know, already, and then I needed to go witness it. And then she very firmly, but also generously, would kind of shut down every single one of my hypotheses about, you know, these new ways that the silent crickets could potentially come up with a new mating strategy, like a dance or running in circles or find a new way to create the sound by rubbing their wing against a blade of grass or finding another species that could potentially work as their decoy once the remaining chirping crickets go extinct. And her bottom line was, nope, once the last chirping cricket goes extinct, all the flatwings, all of the silent crickets will also go extinct because they have no way and no technique for bringing, for drawing a female in. And so hearing that, and then also understanding that there was no footage or documentation of this new behavior and this new species, kind of just catalyzed a very reactive, I guess I just reacted. I felt like I had no time. So I hung up the phone and I booked a flight to Kauai and I rented an infrared camera that I had no idea how to use and got an infrared lamp and went to attempt to capture this myself. And I remember saying, you know, like, if I find these crickets and I get this, you know, macro slow motion footage of their movements and their behavior, like, I'll send it to the lab. And they're like, oh, we don't need it. Like, no need.
Mm-hmm.
Like, thanks, but we have no use for that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, the piece itself is me kind of moving my mind, going through all these different insects and all these animals that I found that night, setting up traps and never finding any crickets because they were A, invisible, or, you know, without the silent ones are very hard to find and the chirping ones are very rare. And
yeah,
Kauai is full of thousands of other species that chirp and make sounds at night. So trying to weed through those sounds with my field recorder was kind of absurd. I mean, there was just a cacophony of like a night symphony that I had forgotten about. Whereas I think in, you know, LA, you can hear just the crickets at night and maybe some other birds. But
yeah,
in Kauai, it's like a whole orchestra. And I had that, you know, that dawned on me pretty quickly on the first night that I was there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, so in California, or at least in Southern California, crickets are relatively high up on the chain because they don't really have any, you know, predators. Whereas in Kauai, they, you know, it's, they only have predators. It seems like they're at the bottom of the chain in a sense.
Oh, I never thought about that. I just thought that snakes and owls and birds also eat crickets here. But maybe not.
I don't know. I mean, they seem to be, they live in urban environment. They are obviously in very urban parts of LA. So in that sense, you know, there's not, yeah, I suppose birds could definitely, would definitely love them if, you know, if they could find them. But I have, as I mentioned to you before, I have a bunch kind of in the rafters of my studio. So
they're doing fine. Yeah.
Yeah. They're doing very, very fine. Yeah. So let's talk about how you got to this point. How would you describe the process of getting selected for the biennial? Maybe that would be as good a place as any to start.
That was a total shock, and I was incredibly honored and had a relationship and studio visits with Jane Panetta, one of the curators, for years before that, and she had come to my performances and really seen works kind of in the process and at beginning phases of things, and was really honored for her to include me and invite me to submit a proposal to the biennial. And at the same time, I already had a conversation. I was having these conversations with Chrissy Isles, the curator who was responsible for Flatwing in this exhibition, and she had also been coming to my performances from, I think, 2013. And she came to see my thesis show. She went to the Bard thesis show in 2018. Mm-hmm. And I was presenting a draft of Flatwing in my studio there. And that's when those conversations began about this work. And the Whitney, then when I finished the piece, acquired Flatwing. And I never thought that that was going to, you know, ever turn into an exhibition. It was my first museum acquisition. It was such a big deal for me. And then I think it was like 6 months after that, Chrissy came back and said that they would like to present the piece as an installation or as an exhibition. So I'm not really sure if the biennial and this really connect up in a linear way, but
yeah. I got you. But no, what I'm interested in sort of the overall trajectories. The analysis, I guess, for lack of a better word, that I'm trying to do is, you know, what kinds of circles, you know, were you traveling in, and what kind of venues were you showing in? You know, these are the kinds of things that connect to, you know, the various studio visits that you eventually had that
totally
led to being in the biennial and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that my first performances were all collaborations, and having artists who were already established and had solo exhibitions at galleries come to me and ask me to do a performance for their opening or something that would be in dialogue with their show. Mm. And, you know, if I hadn't had those opportunities, I don't think I would have ever, you know, that is when those curators who I'd never heard of were present, because they already knew the gallery and they already knew the artist. And it was really this, you know, very generous act of these artists who I love and care about kind of inviting me in and, you know, taking a risk and being like, yes, well, you create a piece that would accompany this. And then we'd talk about it for months, and I would, you know, bring in my dancers and create this piece. And so the whole beginning was all in galleries or outside and kind of self-starting events. And, you know, sharing the space with people who already had the visibility. And that kind of introduced me to that world and to the curators and to writers and to getting some press. And that I feel very fortunate for those opportunities, because it, you know, then led to my first solo show at Drill. I mean, not at Drill, that's the name of the show, Drill, at Signal, which is a really incredible gallery that has now since closed, but was in Bushwick in this very large warehouse, and was able to do this dream piece where I got a hold of 6 evacuation slides from 747 planes, deployed them, and then hung them in the space, kind of like you would see at an aerospace museum where you see airplanes hanging by like suspension cables. And created this piece that was all about the choreography of evacuation routes. And it was a piece that ran every single day for the duration that the gallery was open, and had a rotating cast of dancers so that they could take breaks, but there would always be someone out there moving. And I think that that piece was really what, you know, I guess established, or, you know, that brought in a new audience.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm sorry to interrupt. I you're getting just to where I was wanting to go, which is the question of these artists who you admired and who are having these solo shows, who are inviting you, you know, to do a performance. That's really great and impressive.
Huge.
And so a number of them presumably saw this show that you're describing, and they were like, oh. And two, they must have been aware, seen some of one, at least one of your choreographed performances, right?
I mean, I think some of the first ones, they had really, they were friends and they had known about Gesture Archive and me being a ballet dancer and, you know, had these intense conversations with them and it was more out of trust. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once I had a few pieces and collaborations done, then yes, it was more like, oh, I saw you perform at Jack Hanley for Elizabeth Jaeger's piece, or I saw mm-hmm. you perform at Tina Kim for Alexandra Lehrman's piece. And mm-hmm. and then, yes, it was very much, you know, we saw this piece, we'd love to talk to you about it, or like, do you want to create a proposal for this space? But I also was applying to grants and opportunities and fellowships, like the In Practice Fellowship at the Sculpture Center. And, I was very determined to get more opportunities to create work and get funding to pay the dancers that I was working with. And I think that, being able to document, you know, three or four of these performances that were collaborations really gave me the material to be able to create those applications and submit proposals of my own.
Does it feel like, you know, we remember how earlier in the conversation we talked about, or I sort of made this premise that you were already starting to choreograph and, you know, and make art in a sense early on, straight out of coming off your injury. And, that there had been for several years a lot of dance related work in contemporary art. And you said, yeah, and I thought there wasn't nearly enough. So going back to that, just wondering, as you're talking about all this now, whether the work that you're doing as a dance choreographer working in art, if that is a niche, you know, that you're able to get a lot of attention because it's not a particularly saturated niche, is what I'm awkwardly trying to ask.
Yeah, it's definitely not a saturated niche, but I think that in that same vein, there's not as much criticism towards, you know, there's a lot less critics and people willing to really take a stab at, you know, dissecting the choreography and the performance when their expertise is in sculpture or painting or installation or, you know, some other type of work. And I think that there's still, you know, there are dance critics and then there's art critics. And I feel like the critical eye around performance and dance, you know, except for a very small group of, you know, there's performance artists, there's performance studies, like I'm not saying that, you know, very much exists, but it's still very rare to see like a solo show be purely performance and have that be at, you know, on one level, you know, assigning a value to that is something I'm really interested in, and how you copyright movement sequences and just how that fits into the art market in general and the issues around that I find completely fascinating, and something that I think needs to be brought up more and more. But there is, you know, it does feel like it's still at its like nascent stages, and that I would love for people who are able to, you know, form criticisms and opinions of, you know, paintings and art shows that are kind of more in medium or just not ephemeral form are able to kind of perceive a performance piece as a conceptual artwork or no different.
Two things I want to say to that. One is that basically what you're implying is until you have a gallery show that features, an ongoing version of one of your performances, say, it's going to be hard for it to be written about, right? The other thing is that because performance has, it seems like, become a lot more common over the last several years in contemporary art, not necessarily in commercial gallery spaces, but it's still become a lot more prominent. It seems like anybody who has written about that would be have the vocabulary to write about one of your performances. Would you agree?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. You mentioned doing that earlier version of Flatwing at Bard. Has that been a factor in terms of, you know, your opportunities?
Yeah, it was really the first time. I mean, I felt like I was making a huge investment in going into student debt and, you know, deciding that I was going to see what happens if I actually prioritize my own work and, you know, developing an art practice and choreography and over all of the other jobs that I continuously had. And, you know, it was kind of a scary move because it didn't seem that reasonable or logical. But
yeah, why did you consider educational opportunities where you didn't have to go into debt?
Yeah, I did, and I really was struck by or pulled in by the instructors and the professors at Bard, and was really excited about working with Alexander Sagad and Charlie Atlas and Kevin Jerome Everson and these kind of heroes of mine who very much straddle disciplines and aren't just in film or in performance or in, and, you know, they really are hovering between realms in a way that I related to and felt that working with them directly would help me kind of discover where or how I wanted to develop my work. And, you know, I'm still unclear as to where it falls into and whether I'm a choreographer or a artist or a filmmaker. And I mean, it's obviously not about categories, but I saw in the film video department at Bard, I saw a type of hybrid fusion along all of the mediums that
right.
was really exciting and worthwhile for me to jump into.
Yeah, and you don't have to be any one of those things. You can be all of them.
Exactly. And that's a little hard when you're applying to schools and they're asking you to, you know, submit your media from that one,
right.
for that one discipline that you're entering. And I didn't feel that way when applying to Bard at all.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Did you get the pleasure of presenting your work in front of, you know, the 100+ people in one of those intense seminar?
Oh my gosh, seminars? Yeah. I mean, my heart starts pounding just thinking about that day.
Tell me about it.
I mean, it's so wonderful because you're just forced to expose everything and every inch of everything along the way. You know, when you're halfway through a project, when you think you're finished, but you actually realize you're just halfway through, and you're in constant dialogue with your community. And I found that really valuable because you're forced to just continuously rearticulate your ideas and question how you are presenting things and you're talking about things and how you're understanding other people's work and how you can help each other. And you find these teams of people that, you know, I still go to when I need another pair of eyes and I want to discuss, you know, it has continued on in ways that I could never have dreamed of. And I'm really grateful for that community.
That's great. Sounds like you got your money's worth.
I did get my money's worth. yeah.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah, really great to talk to you too.
And we are